and ultimately ever more destructive directions. In France and Belgium in particular, the army made further efforts to maintain relations with native collaborationist administrations and keep the general population on side. In 1943, following the Battle of Stalingrad, some saner elements within the Reich's leadership came to believe that it needed more than ever to command the support of occupied European populations if it were to have any chance of enduring in the war, let alone winning it. With this aim in mind, such elements tried to promote an image of the war as an anti-Bolshevik crusade behind which all Europe could and should unify. Even as prominent and fanatical a Nazi as Goebbels sought to harness propaganda in this cause, asserting in February 1943 that to secure victory we must mobilize not only all the available energies of the German people, but also those nations which inhabit the territories which have been occupied and conquered by us in the course of the war. All the forces of the European continent must be deployed in the struggle against Jewish Bolshevism. The army's occupation authorities in the West were generally at one with such views. At the same time, however, the German occupation as a whole undercut its rhetoric by placing ever greater stress on exploiting occupied Europe's economies than on cultivating its peoples. Goering, in his capacity as head of the four-year plan, encapsulated this brutish view when he addressed a conference of Reich commissioners and military governors in Berlin in August 1942. "I have the reports of what you are planning to deliver in front of me. When I contemplate your countries, it seems like nothing at all. I could not care less if you told me that your people are collapsing from hunger. They can do that by all means, so long as no German collapses from hunger." The acrimony generated by the ransacking of the continent became a new burden for the army's occupation forces because it increased resistance to German rule. So, too, did the fact that Germany began to look ever less likely to win the war. And such was the economic and political chaos that increasingly engulfed the German army's occupied Balkan territories that the occupiers had little prospect of cultivating their populations anyway. The resistance that emerged, particularly in Yugoslavia, was all the fiercer for this. The army's main answer to this challenge was another under-resourced, often brutal counterinsurgency campaign. The other momentous development across occupied Europe during this period, one in which the army was again heavily involved, was the full-scale continent-wide onset of the Final Solution. By 1943, the economic burdens the Germans were imposing upon France's economy, together with the effects of the British blockade, had reduced the country's output by a third compared with pre-war levels. In January of that year, daily calorie consumption in the country was 1,080, compared with 1,980 in Germany. Thus did one Parisian woman record her thankless search for food in May 1942. 7:30 hours, to the baker's, buy bread, there will be biscuits at 1,100 hours. 900 hours, it is a meat day today, but the butcher says there won't be any until Saturday. 9:30 hours, to the dairy shop, no cheese before 5 p.m. 1,000 hours, to the tripe shop, my ticket is number 32, I will be served at 4 p.m. 10:30 hours, to the grocer's, there will be vegetables at 5 p.m. 1,100 hours, back to the baker's, there are no biscuits left. In Belgium, particularly dependent upon food imports since the war's start, food kitchens were in action as early as the beginning of 1942. While more affluent bourgeois circles could afford the black market, one survey conducted that year concluded that more than 50% of workers were already 5 kilograms below their normal body weight. Malnourishment precipitated a rise in death rates and, towards the end of the occupation, in infant mortality. Then, in October of that year, Goering's Office of the Four-Year Plan dragooned German occupation administrators into squeezing as many foodstuffs from their territories as possible. Across Western Europe, the military authorities at least set maximum quantities for the goods that German soldiers themselves could send or take back to Germany. By the autumn of 1942, however, these restrictions were being limited to Germanic countries, Denmark, Norway, and the Netherlands, and even these were suffering. In particular, Norway faced continued demands from the Wehrmacht to finance its massive construction projects in the country. Western Europe, unlike parts of Eastern and Southern Europe, did not starve during the war. But from 1942, the economic pressure that the Reich was exerting upon occupied Europe, Western Europe included, escalated once more. This latest economic assault was upon the continent's labor force. Drawing labor from occupied Western Europe became important to the Reich once it was clear that Britain intended to continue the war and that the Reich would therefore need to draft more German workers into the armed forces. The need for European labor increased again following the invasion of the Soviet Union. Initially, the German occupation authorities in France and Belgium, as with other German occupation authorities in much of Europe, sought to secure labor voluntarily. In France, the military government established recruiting offices in major cities and offered high wages and health insurance benefits. Its efforts met with considerable success. By the spring of 1942, 275,000 French workers were building airfields and fortifications along the Atlantic coast, and 400,000 were working for the Germans in French armaments factories. French volunteers for work in the Reich itself also rose in number. But in January 1942, Göring's Office of the Four-Year Plan, increasingly set on squeezing Europe's economies for all they were worth, called upon all German occupation administrations to mobilize more manpower for the Reich. Fritz Sauckel's appointment as Reich plenipotentiary for labor allocation heralded this new phase. It did not result in a sudden tidal wave of press ganging in Western Europe any more than it did in the Soviet Union, but it did intensify the Reich's economic demands upon Western Europe to a degree that eventually drove up resistance to German rule. In France, for instance, it was clear by September 1942 that Sauckel's intensified drive for workers had failed to attract enough volunteers. That month, the military government imposed the first compulsory labor measures upon the French population, requiring men between 18 and 50 and unmarried women between 21 and 35 to work at least 30 hours per week. Workers were frozen in their current jobs, and firms seeking to hire new workers now needed permission from the French authorities. Such measures still fell far short of press ganging, but they certainly represented a stringent labor regulation scheme. The military government took part in negotiations between Sauckel and the Vichy regime as the latter attempted to prevent full-blown labor conscription. Eventually, Sauckel agreed to grant leave of absence to one French POW for every French worker sent to the Reich. Meanwhile, Otto von Stulpnagel's resignation as military governor in February 1942 had seen his replacement by another aristocratic conservative, his own cousin Karl Heinrich. But though Hitler clearly considered military administrations useful in some way, otherwise he would have scrapped them altogether, he no longer considered the military government in Paris capable of dealing firmly enough either with the Jewish question or with the ongoing resistance to the occupation. This gave the SS and police the opportunity for an extensive power grab in France. In June 1942, Himmler appointed Brigadeführer Karl Oberg senior SS and police leader in France, at the same time as appointing other such leaders for Serbia, Norway, and the Netherlands. Oberg assumed extensive powers over and above those of the military government, that of reprisals included. Oberg's appointment did not unleash an unbridled reign of terror. He generally worked well with Stulpnagel, having served alongside him during the First World War. He also eventually recognized that mass executions were no longer viable, if only for the pragmatic reason that there were no longer enough foreign Jews or communists left to kill, and that executing ordinary Frenchmen or even naturalized French Jews en masse might inflame rather than stifle resistance. But Oberg's appointment exemplified a growing trend in both East and West from 1942 onwards, as the SS and police increasingly muscled in on the army's security turf and infused the occupation overall with a more ruthless character. Indeed, most GFP groups in France were disbanded that year, and their personnel transferred to the SS and police. Over the following 2 years, the SS and police would periodically expand its power in France further still, opening main branches in Paris, Autun, Dijon, and Rouen, and employing approximately 200 personnel in each office by 1944. In the middle of these negotiations over labor conscription, relations between Vichy and the Reich turned dramatically when Vichy French forces folded before the Allied invasion of French North Africa in November 1942. Hitler now ordered the Wehrmacht to take direct military control of the southern Free Zone of France. The region was now redesignated as Coastal Sector Mediterranean. Rather than coming under the military government's jurisdiction, however, it became the charge of OB West, the German Army Command in the West, which had operational command of the German defences in France. Heading OB West from March 1942 was the newly reactivated Field Marshal von Rundstedt. The Germans needed to retain the Vichy government, for they still could not control France themselves without the apparatus of an indigenous administration. But now more than ever, the Germans treated the Vichy regime as a pliable executor of their will. Anxious to prove its collaborationist credentials and suffused by ever more extreme political elements, in February 1943 the Vichy regime introduced the Compulsory Labour Law, Service du Travail Obligatoire, or STO. This required all French workers between 20 and 22, unless they were essential to the French economy, to work in Germany. Failure to comply would bring fines and internment. Initially, a quarter of a million workers were sent to the Reich by the end of March, but Hitler wanted another million. The STO destroyed what remained of the Vichy government's standing in the population's eyes and fueled an exodus of draft dodgers into the countryside. Sauckel tried to compensate to some extent by offering more POWs a brief furlough in France, improved wages, and the same rights as voluntary French workers if they renounced their prisoner status and became voluntary labourers themselves. This measure enabled him to raise a further 600,000 workers for service in the Reich. But the surge of draft dodging increased when Hitler demanded yet another million workers for 1944. Only 32,000 workers would be procured during the occupation's final 7 months. The German army in France had not been instrumental in agreeing to the STO. However, the fugitive population that had now established itself in the less penetrable regions of the French countryside, particularly in the mountainous areas of the south, would form a bedrock for a growing rural resistance movement, the Maquis, during 1943 and 1944. In time, this would prove to be a development that was certain to concern the army. Meanwhile, thanks in large part to Charles de Gaulle's representative on the ground, Jean Moulin, connections between French resistance groups developed considerably. Among other things, Moulin was instrumental in setting up joint services for the resistance, including the Bureau d'Information et de Presse, in April 1942. The BIP was a clearinghouse of material from and for the resistance, and circulated articles to the underground press or to the foreign press, particularly in Britain and the United States. Moulin was also extensively involved in the negotiations that led to the creation of an umbrella organization for the main resistance groups, the Mouvements Unis de la Résistance, MUR, in January 1943. By now, the resistance was being supplied with small arms and other equipment by the British, and was operating escape lines that eventually enabled around 33,000 Allied personnel to be returned safely to Britain over the war's course. They also gathered intelligence for the Allies on such matters as German troop movements. The majority of resistors came from the poorer sections of the population, who were particularly susceptible to the anti-conservative message of the resistance groups operating under the aegis of the Parti Communiste Français, PCF. But the resistance generally also drew on other diverse groups, including professionals, the petit bourgeoisie, and some aristocrats. Nevertheless, the German occupation authorities enjoyed a considerable success in their efforts to suppress the French resistance during 1942 to 1943. The PCF leader responsible for liaising with de Gaulle's forces was positively boastful about the effects that German reprisal shootings were having upon the communist resistance. He claimed to his Free French opposite number that, as soon as the news is given out that 5 or 10 of our men have been shot, we get 50 or 100 new recruits. But these were exaggerated figures, and though the PCF was adept at attracting new recruits, the German and Vichy government forces proved almost as adept at killing them. Perhaps the Germans' biggest coup against the resistance came in March 1943, after they seized a suitcase full of documents in Lyon containing the names, many of which were uncoded, of 163 members of the MUR and the Armée Secrète, the fledgling armed wing of the resistance in the erstwhile Free Zone. In both France and Belgium, the end of the Battle of Stalingrad and the obvious turn in Germany's military fortunes further emboldened young men and women to dodge the labor draft. Groups such as the Jeunesse Ouvrière Chrétienne, young Christian workers in Belgium, helped them, and many French and Belgian policemen, charged with assembling workers for the draft, now instead covered for draft evaders. The military government in Brussels was more active in the labor drive than the military government in Paris. Brigadeführer Raeder's concern for the military government to look dynamic and proactive in the eyes of Berlin may have played a role here. A particular pace-setter for the military government seems to have been the civilian administration in the Netherlands, which imposed compulsory labor measures upon the Dutch population as early as February 1941. By July 1941, the military government in Brussels was seeking to encourage Belgian civilians to work in Germany by threatening them with the alternative prospect of setting them to particularly undesirable labor tasks for public works projects in Belgium. In March 1942, it passed a decree empowering it to direct civilians to designated workplaces in Belgium. In October, it then announced that all men between 18 and 50 and all women between 21 and 35 were liable for labor service in Germany. This measure in particular was deeply unpopular with the population because it awoke bitter memories of the deportations the Germans had inflicted during the First World War. The military government was unreceptive to pleas by collaborationist groups and government figures to allow Belgian workers to remain working in Belgium on the Germans' behalf. In the spring of 1943, the military government began calling up workers by age group. This measure was successful during its first 6 months, with over 100,000 Belgian workers departing for Germany. However, the number being recruited for work in Germany began to drop in May 1943. From then until December, fewer than 49,000 were recruited. Too much of Belgium's rural landscape was flat and open for a Maquis-type movement, but the labor draft certainly drove large numbers of young Belgian men and women underground. Moreover, together with other stifling regulations upon daily life, the draft made the population more restive and resentful, and thus fueled more clandestine types of resistance indirectly. In general, given its small size, concentrated population, developed transport infrastructure, and largely flat and open terrain, Belgium was particularly ill-suited turf for a large, visible, and active resistance organization. Belgian resistance to the occupation was therefore sensibly low-key. Its two main military organizations were the pro-communist Front de l'Indépendance and the Armée Secrète, not to be confused with its French namesake, an organization that was run along military lines by former professional army officers. Like all Western European resistance movements for much of the war, neither group sought to provoke the Germans excessively, knowing full well the price the civilian population would pay in reprisals. Instead, they sought largely to build their forces in secret in preparation to assist in their country's eventual liberation. Neither group was initially enthusiastic to cooperate with the government in exile in London, for fear of the control that the government in exile might seek to exercise over them. Over time, however, both came to cooperate with the government in exile, albeit reluctantly. They recognized that they needed access to weapons and other forms of military assistance which only the government in exile, through the Allies, could provide. For its part, the government in exile needed a force on the ground with which it could show the Allies that it would be able to assist in the eventual liberation of Belgium. But resistance on the ground was highly dispersed and decentralized. As well as the aforementioned young Christian workers, the Belgian resistance also encompassed such groups as welfare organizations, intelligence networks, some of which had been created by the British, and escape groups for fugitive Allied servicemen. In its efforts to combat the Belgian resistance, the military government, still mindful of the need not to alienate the population unnecessarily, sought to keep the security police and SD on some kind of leash. In February 1942, for instance, Raeder authorized them to detain people for up to 7 days, but required them to obtain written permission from the military government for any longer than that. Compelled to rely less on terror and more on investigative policing methods, albeit buttressed by the liberal use of torture, the security police and SD were able during the summer of 1943 to infiltrate and wipe out most of the leadership of both the Belgian Communist Party and the FI. But the winter of 1942 to 1943 had already ushered in a decisive change in the German occupation of Belgium. As the tide of war slowly turned, the military government sought to exploit the Belgian economy more extensively, and the established Belgian administration increasingly dragged its feet in implementing the Germans' wishes. Extremist collaborators, on whom the Germans had already been increasingly relying to raise Belgian military volunteers for the Eastern Front, now became a mainstay of security and administration for the military government. By the spring of 1942, the deportation of Jews from across occupied Europe to the extermination camps in the East was in full swing. Such deportations had their own momentum, for each time one was carried out, it made further deportations look increasingly viable. Also, the SS felt a particular urgency in getting Jews onto the trains during the spring and early summer of 1942, because the sooner they were deposited in the East, the sooner the trains could be reused for the German offensive in the southern Soviet Union. Initially, the military authorities in the occupied territories tried to hold on to Jews as a source of labor. However, this was a pragmatic rather than a humane stance. In any case, the army lost control over the matter after July 1942, when the SS took charge of all Jewish forced labor. Indeed, the entire Wehrmacht was compelled to accept this change when Field Marshal Keitel formally endorsed it in September, invoking Hitler's words, "Evacuation of the Jews must be carried out thoroughly, and its consequences endured, despite any trouble it may cause over the next 3 or 4 months." As commander of the 17th Army in the Ukraine in 1941, Karl Heinrich von Stulpnagel had explicitly singled out Jews as reprisal victims. On his arrival in France, he ordered that future reprisals should take the form of deportations of Jews to the East. In March, over 1,100 were sent to Auschwitz. Yet in other respects, Stulpnagel showed himself less anti-Semitic in the West than in the East. Perhaps the campaign in the Soviet Union brought his anti-Semitism particularly to the fore because he strongly associated Jews with Bolshevism. In France, Stulpnagel used creative accounting to reduce the number of actual executions. From the spring of 1942 onwards, Stulpnagel can have had no doubts about the likely fate of Jewish deportees. Yet he also refused to provide military assistance for deportations organized by the SS. Indeed, in July 1944, Himmler claimed that Stulpnagel's difficult, obstructive behavior was preventing the complete annihilation of the French Jews. That same month, Stulpnagel would play a key role in the anti-Nazi coup that the military conspirators tried to orchestrate following their attempt to assassinate Hitler. All this suggests that at least part of his motive for complying with some high-level decrees against Jews was a double game to maintain appearances. Generally, albeit not always, indigenous police forces, collaborators, and administrators did the main legwork of processing and assembling Jews for collection across the Western occupied territories. For its part, the Vichy regime was happy to exploit at least some of the anti-Semitism that contaminated French society and see the back of Jews who were not of French citizenship. March 1942 saw the first group of deportees from France arrive at Auschwitz to be gassed. In July, French police and collaborators swept up 13,000 stateless Jews in Paris in the particularly notorious Ville d'Yves roundup. By the end of the year, 42,000 Jews had been deported from France. The military government's hands were far from clean in these matters. Though Stulpnagel did not want military personnel dirtying its hands in the deportations, the army head of the French railways, Lieutenant General Otto Kohl, was a dyed-in-the-wool anti-Semite who expedited the deportations as much as he could. More generally, the military government sought to minimize its involvement in the deportations, not only to avoid sullying the army's image, but also because it feared that mass deportations would disrupt the French economy. And the Vichy regime, while ready to deport non-French Jews, feared that deporting assimilated French Jews to the extermination camps would dangerously unsettle the wider population. Hitler and Ribbentrop got to work on Pierre Laval, the Vichy prime minister, exploiting his intense anti-communism and his fear of Anglo-Saxon hegemony to secure his support for the rounding up of French Jews. Laval remained reluctant, not for principled reasons, but because he feared public unrest, and because he failed to secure any diplomatic concessions from the Germans in return. He acquiesced, nevertheless, and by the summer of 1943 probably realized that, although Germany was likely to lose the war, his own life would be forfeit if he tried to change course. Overall, fewer French Jews died during the Holocaust than might have been the case. The proportion for France was 25%, an awful indictment of the German occupation and the Vichy regime, but far short of the proportion of the Netherlands at 75%. From 1 June 1942, the SS had authority to bypass the military government over the deportations, but without extensive native and interagency help, there was a limit to what it could do. From 1943 onwards, the French authorities, from government ministers down to policemen, increasingly dragged their feet over the deportations. In April 1944, Standartenführer Knochen, no longer concerned about accommodating the Vichy regime, ordered the SS, assisted by new French paramilitary organizations, to arrest all remaining Jews in France, irrespective of age or citizenship status. 15,000 Jews were sent to their deaths between January and August 1944. However, this was the final surge in the campaign to murder the Jews of France. It fell far short of the 42,000 who had been deported for extermination in 1942. Efforts to exterminate the Jewish population of Belgium displayed some significant differences. Most importantly, the absence of a senior SS and police leader in Belgium meant that it was the military government in Brussels that set the pace. And though it did not comport itself with special anti-Semitic zeal, neither did it try to obstruct the deportation of Jews in the way Karl Heinrich von Stulpnagel did. In April 1942, German Jews living in Belgium were declared stateless and their property forfeit, and the next 6 months saw foreign Jews deported to the extermination camps. A directive Raeder issued that summer indicates very strongly that the military government knew what the Jews' eventual fate would be, however euphemistic his language. With these measures, the legislation dealing with the Jews and Belgium may be considered complete. The Jews have extremely limited ways of earning a living. The next step now would be the evacuation from Belgium, which will, however, not be initiated locally, but will be started by the competent offices in the Reich within the context of the general plan. Raeder calculated correctly that the Belgian authorities were not prepared to see Belgian Jews deported, but also that they would not stand in the way of German efforts to deport emigrants and other foreigners, as long as the German police rather than the Belgian police did the job. Foreign Jews comprised 90% of the 10,000 Jews who were deported in September 1942. By the end of the month, Raeder was seeking to deport all remaining non-native Jews, save those in mixed marriages and a few other exemptions. But Raeder's motive for such leniency was probably practical rather than moral, as probably was his motive for seeking to keep Jewish families together as much as possible during the evacuations. It is the task of the German security police to carry out the action in a way that keeps as low a profile as possible and arouses no sympathy among the population for the Jews. From November onwards, the German police hunted down those non-native Jews who had escaped the net. Falkenhausen, fearful of the damage that deporting assimilated Belgian Jews might do to peace and order, did not authorize this next step until July 1943. By then, large numbers of Belgian Jews had used the delay to disperse or go to ground. In the event, an incident took place that threatened to precipitate the very unrest that the military government feared. 145 Jews were rounded up in Antwerp and piled into a furniture van destined for Brussels. When the truck finally arrived, 9 people were dead, 80 were unconscious, and several had gone mad. Raeder now scaled back the hunt, forbade further large-scale cleansing actions, and arranged for a number of Belgian Jews already in captivity to be released. Eventually, 25,000 Jewish men, women, and children were deported by the German police, with limited help from the Wehrmacht's gendarmerie, but more extensive help from Belgian collaborators. By the war's end, 40% of the country's pre-war Jewish population had been deported for extermination. The military government's involvement in the murder of Belgium's Jews was damning. In this, as in most other areas of its operation, it was Raeder rather than Falkenhausen who was the driving force. At best, and this may well be stretching things, Both men may have considered it a necessary price of discouraging Hitler from replacing the military government with a Reich Commissar and a stronger SS and police presence. By this, they might have hoped to assure more tolerable conditions for the bulk of Belgium's population. But even if this was their motivation, they were making a putrid moral compromise. Nevertheless, the fact that both French and Belgian Jews still had a better chance of surviving the Holocaust than Dutch Jews was partly due to both countries being under military governance. The SS and police in Belgium had no senior SS and police leader who might have coaxed still firmer action out of the military government in Brussels. Though the SS and police in France did have a senior SS and police leader at their head, the military government in Paris still managed largely to drag its feet over the deportations. Other reasons for French and Belgian Jews' greater survival chances had much less to do with the army, however. The SS and police in the Netherlands also had a greater number of zealous anti-Semitic collaborators at their disposal. Furthermore, in the case of Belgium, Jews were thin on the ground, had retained a fringe presence in society, and had made less effort to integrate. They were therefore less enmeshed in the Belgian state's administrative records and harder to locate. It also helped that Reder generally deemed it unnecessary for Jews to be marked out in public. It is also worth stressing that the German army's occupation forces in the Netherlands were not passive bystanders in the much more comprehensive annihilation of that country's Jews. Under the Wehrmacht commander in the Netherlands, Luftwaffe General Friedrich Christiansen, the army was not a driving force behind anti-Semitic policy there. Nevertheless, it provided logistical support for Jewish roundups and also helped hunt down and apprehend fugitives who had escaped. At the other end of Europe, in Greece, the German army and the Wehrmacht more widely played a more active role in persecuting and deporting the country's Jews. Until September 1943, the direct German occupation of Greece was restricted to certain islands and mainland enclaves. Well before that date, however, the Germans had wiped Jews from their Greek territory. Many non-Jewish Greeks took the courageous action of aiding and sheltering Jews, but ultimately only around 22,000 of the country's 80,000 Jews escaped deportation or managed to survive it. The Germans' efforts to deport the Jews of Athens in early 1943 largely failed because most of the city's Jewish population took a lead from the chief rabbi and escaped into the hills to join the partisans. It was a different story in Salonika, however. The SS and police, with assistance from the Greek police and logistical help from the Wehrmacht, deported the city's Jews in the spring of 1943, and the previous year the army itself had subjected Salonika's Jewish population to exploitative and degrading treatment. In July 1942, General Kurt von Krensky, the Wehrmacht commander in northern Greece, ordered the Feldkommandantur in Salonika to set the Jews in its jurisdiction to hard labor repairing roads and airfields. Officers on the spot used the order as an opportunity to humiliate the Jews. Before being assigned to work details, Jewish men were forced to stand in the sun in the main city squares. The most humiliating aspect of this action was that it forced the men to stand for hours on a Saturday without being allowed to wear hats, in callous disregard for Jewish religious etiquette. The episode also further highlighted the contempt in which many ordinary German soldiers held the Jews. For at the same time as Salonika's male Jewish population was being publicly degraded, German troops were ransacking Jewish property in the city, destroying Jewish cemeteries, blowing up synagogues, and requisitioning other synagogues as makeshift stables for their horses. Partisan resistance in Greece began developing on the mainland in 1942, in large part as a reaction to the dreadful famine conditions of the previous winter. It initially centered on the Pindus region. The Pindus Mountains ran from the Greco-Albanian border down to the northern Peloponnese. The region had a long tradition of resisting central government control, and by the winter of 1942 to 1943, it saw a flowering of partisan groups, many of which were centered on local warlords. The partisans were bitterly split between the National Republican Greek League, Ethnikos Demokratikos Ellinikos Sundesmos, or EDES, and the Communist National Liberation Front, Ethniko Apelefterotiko Metopo, or EAM, together with the front's military wing, the Greek People's Liberation Army, Ellenikos Laikos Apelefterotikos Stratos, or ELAS. Yet partisans still became increasingly numerous and active. They were able to establish themselves across Greece's rural areas all the more easily because, until September 1943, the bulk of the country was occupied not by the Germans, but by the Italians. Belying the amiable celluloid image beloved of movies like Captain Corelli's Mandolin, Italian units stationed in Greece often destroyed purportedly pro-partisan villages and sometimes killed civilians en masse. However, they were rather less effective than the Germans when it came to killing actual partisans. On their own turfs, such as Athens and Salonika, the Germans were shooting hostages en masse by early 1943, hoping that this measure would strangle popular support for the Greek partisans, as it apparently had strangled that of the partisans in Serbia in 1941. Yet though the shootings were immensely brutal, they did not prevent instances of sabotage and assassination from rising alarmingly that summer, or total partisan numbers increasing to over 25,000. The Germans had misunderstood why conditions in Greece made a successful reprisal campaign far less likely there than in Serbia. General Boehmer's reprisal policy in Serbia in 1941 had put destructive pressure upon the already fragile alliance between Chetniks and partisans. This had then enabled the Germans to discount the Chetniks and defeat a partisan force foolish enough to try to take them on in conventional battle. But in Greece there was no enemy alliance to split, and neither Edes nor Elas were employing the sort of fighting methods that played obligingly into the Germans' hands. By the summer of 1943, partisan resistance was continuing to spread across Greece. The total number of Greek partisans did not approach communist partisan numbers in Yugoslavia, but their knowledge of the land, their levels of support, and, particularly in the case of Elas, the effective measures of social, economic, and political organization that they introduced into the areas they controlled, together made them elusive, resourceful, and dangerous opponents. In response, a growing number of hardened German army units from both the army and the Waffen-SS was now arriving in Greece with the task of subjugating partisan resistance permanently. They were about to subject much of the country to even worse terrors than before. Yet the scale of partisan action, Axis counter-terror, and general chaos in Greece was dwarfed by what was happening in Yugoslavia. Serbia did not remain entirely quiescent during 1942 and 1943. It was dotted with pockets of partisan and occasionally Chetnik resistance. But Serbia was no longer the main hotspot for anti-Axis resistance in Yugoslavia. The NDH was. In the NDH, as elsewhere, economic misery did much to fuel resistance. Because the NDH was officially a sovereign state, the Germans were unable to exploit its economy as heavily as they could Serbia's. Nevertheless, they were able to pressure the Ustasha regime into relinquishing tens of thousands of workers for labor service in the Reich. They also gained access to a large portion of the NDH's oil and minerals, including its bauxite mines. They imposed massive occupation costs on the NDH, as elsewhere, compelling the Ustasha regime to print more money and triggering runaway inflation in the process. If anything, the Italians plundered their parts of the NDH with even more gusto, as well as seeking to assimilate them culturally. The majority of Croats not only groaned under these burdens, but also grew increasingly war-weary, as well as fearful that they would be blamed collectively for the Ustasha's atrocities should the Axis lose the war. And yet there were further reasons why anti-Axis resistance there became so strong, many of them the result of the particular ethnic makeup of the NDH. In 1942, Tito's partisans reconstituted and regenerated their movement amid the NDH's mountainous terrain, most prominently in Bosnia. They had bitter rivals in the Bosnian Serb Chetniks. Indeed, the war in the NDH soon developed into a struggle not just between occupiers and occupied, but also between ethnic and political groups among the occupied. The Bosnian Chetniks sought to assert Serb supremacy in the region and often terrorized, expelled, or slaughtered Croatian and Muslim communities. The cycle of ethnic terror and counter-terror, and the further blight they inflicted upon Axis attempts to administer and exploit NDH territory during 1942, were attested to by the 718th Infantry Division. Its operations section reported, There is hardly a Serb, Croat, or Muslim in the whole of eastern Bosnia who does not have some kind of blood feud to settle with another. While its intelligence section commented, Ustasha, partisans, and Chetniks are, as before, competing to carry off the strife cup. They're all as bad as each other, type sentiments notwithstanding, partisan units were more disciplined than those of the Bosnian Chetniks and the Ustasha, and terrorized civilian communities to nothing like the same extent. Indeed, they pledged to shield Muslims from Chetnik attacks, at the same time as impressing ethnic Serbs with their military effectiveness, which was considerably greater than that of the Chetniks. Partisan propaganda vilified the allegedly treacherous reactionary nature of the NDH and Nedic governments. The partisans also introduced political and economic reforms in the growing number of regions they controlled, showcasing the socially and ethnically egalitarian society they were pledged to create. All this boosted partisan support and recruitment levels across the NDH's ethnic groups. Tito boosted the partisans' appeal further when, in autumn 1942, he brought them into a Popular Front Association, the Anti-Fascist Council of the People's Liberation of Yugoslavia, Antifascističko Vijeće Narodnog Oslobođenja Jugoslavije, or AVNOJ, with non-communist groups. Meanwhile, the partisans used their increasingly secure geographical bases to augment their military and political power. Among other things, they reorganized and retrained their forces, concentrating their best troops into elite units, the well-disciplined and mobile proletarian brigades. There was cynicism behind the partisans' way of operating, for partisan units too perpetrated bloody sectarian excesses. Moreover, when they finally assumed power at the national level in 1945, they would subject thousands of opponents, real or suspected, to a vast bloody purge. But by at least keeping their brutality within certain limits during the war itself, they reaped the reward of growing inter-ethnic support when it mattered most. The partisans' progress during this period was far from smooth. Almost from the moment Tito's forces arrived in the NDH, Axis forces launched a series of offensives against the partisans that inflicted intermittently massive disruption. For a variety of reasons, however, the Axis failed to deliver a truly decisive blow. Although the Wehrmacht tried to occupy Yugoslavia without investing large resources, Wehrmacht Command Southeast's army formations in the NDH increasingly recognized they could not rely on the Italians, the Ustasha, or the Bosnian Chetniks to keep the partisans in check. The Italians were frequently unreliable, sometimes to the point of failing to support German anti-partisan operations to which they had previously pledged troops. In July 1942, they widened the power vacuum by scaling back their own military commitment in the NDH. The Italians also worsened matters by organizing Chetnik forces into an anti-communist volunteer militia, Milizia Volontaria Anticomunista, or MVAC, for use in a proxy war against the partisans. Even some German units toyed with this idea, but the Chetniks proved less adept in irregular warfare than the partisans. Arming them merely stoked inter-ethnic strife further. The NDH forces, with the exception of some elite Ustasha units, were of an even shoddier military standard. The NDH army was crippled by low morale and by shortages in clothing, equipment, arms, and ammunition. All this, of course, made the army's rank and file more likely to desert and respond to partisan influence. The regional and local level NDH administration was generally too corrupt and ineffective to maintain order. The Germans nevertheless kept the Ustasha regime in power, partly because Hitler admired the Ustasha's radicalism, and partly because to some extent the Germans could use the Chetniks as leverage against the Ustasha. Moreover, the Ustasha regime hated the Italians for their arrogance and greed, and this made it easier for the Germans to present their own economic demands upon the NDH as being more reasonable. The same grubby power political considerations that kept the Ustasha in power nationally, of course, enabled Ustasha militias to continue spreading mayhem on the ground. Because the NDH was officially allied to the Germans, executing hostages en masse as an anti-partisan measure was not an option. During 1942 and into the first half of 1943, therefore, the Wehrmacht tried to destroy the partisan movement directly in a succession of Großunternehmen similar to those the Germans practiced in the East. The Germans did not rely completely on such bludgeoning tactics. For instance, the army also converted its core occupation divisions in Yugoslavia, the 704th, 714th, 717th, and 718th Infantry, to better equipped, more mobile light divisions. For part of 1942, at least, moreover, officers showed some restraint. Apart from anything else, this enabled them to look better next to the Ustasha in the population's eyes. For August 1942's Operation S, for instance, the 718th declared, "Every opportunity must be taken to make clear to the population, in word and deed, that this action is directed entirely against the partisans, and that those who are willing to work will enjoy the protection of German and Croatian arms. It is therefore forbidden, 1, to burn down houses unless the battle makes it unavoidable, and 2, to deprive the population of its livestock or food supply." And the 117th's Lieutenant General Benignus Dippold was among the commanders who urged proper treatment for captured partisans, asserting, "One must view the enemy as poorly equipped troops, but not as bandits." It was not long, however, before brutality outweighed imagination and restraint. The army still employed too many substandard units, despite the introduction of light divisions. Among other things, it still had to deploy some indigenous and allied units in their operations. Most importantly, the Germans continued to rely on Großunternehmen. Just as in the Soviet Union, and for similar reasons, the Großunternehmen that the Germans conducted in the NDH failed to destroy partisan concentrations conclusively and killed enormous numbers of non-combatants instead. In Yugoslavia, again as in the Soviet Union, the Germans also failed to follow up such successes as they did score with sustained pressure on the partisans or sufficient troops on the ground between operations. Moreover, their brutality, particularly their widespread practice of shooting partisans who were trying to desert, boosted both the partisans' support and their determination not to fall captive. German-led offensives certainly caused massive disruption to the partisans. For instance, the trio operations of the spring of 1942 pushed Tito's main force into a long march from eastern to western Bosnia. But because the Germans regularly set targets that were overambitious for forces that were inferior, they could not stop large numbers of partisans from escaping and reforming elsewhere. The German economy's growing demand for labor also lent some anti-partisan operations the character of the press gang. Such was the case with the 714th Infantry Division's Operation Kozera in June and July 1942. German units also acted brutally because the vast mountainous regions of the NDH, especially Bosnia, were the perfect environment for bringing out the regular soldiers' fear and hatred of guerrilla warfare. Lieutenant Peter G. of the 714th Infantry Division wrote a succession of letters during the second half of 1942 giving voice to this. "Yesterday the battalion exterminated 650 partisans in combat," he wrote on 6 September. "The first time any battalion in West Bosnia achieved this, but we lost our best NCO, whom the scum managed to capture. We found him that evening. They'd pulled his fingernails out while he was still alive, chopped his fingers and his genitals off, sawed off a leg, and then finally they shot him. I also told you a lieutenant had gone missing. The enemy had nailed him alive to a door and then tortured him to death with a red-hot iron." The ghoulishness of the account may reflect its writer's own nervous state more than what was actually taking place. Even so, partisan units' capacity for savagery towards their prisoners is well attested. In any case, by describing such atrocities, G. showed that he was slipping into a mind frame that justified all manner of brutality in the anti-partisan campaign. Later in the year, as the partisans grew more powerful, his letters exude a growing sense of helplessness. "Today things were black," he wrote in mid-December. "The partisans surprised our battalion. There were 6 dead, 16 wounded, 2 missing, and 28 dead horses. Naturally, this is again an enormous blow, of the sort we won't be able to withstand much longer. If we don't get German reinforcements soon, then we will all be in the shit." Officers who did try to place the anti-partisan campaign on a more constructive footing received no effective help from the center. They were subject not only to the brutal injunctions emanating from Hitler and the OKW during the second half of 1942, but also to the similarly brutal injunctions of Balkan theater commanders. General Walter Kuntze, the Athens-based Wehrmacht commander southeast, declared in March 1942, "Captured rebels are in principle to be hanged or shot. If they are to be used for intelligence purposes, this should only be a brief postponement of their death." Kuntze's successor from August 1942, the Austrian-born Luftwaffe General Alexander Löhr, was of a like mind. In late October, he issued a Balkan-specific version of Hitler's commando order, with ruthless additions of his own. "All visible enemy groups are, under all circumstances, to be exterminated to the last man. Only when every rebel realizes that he will not escape with his life under any circumstances can the occupation troops expect to master the rebel movement. I expect every commander to commit his entire person to ensuring that this order, without exception and in a brutally harsh spirit, is executed by the troops. I will investigate every transgression and bring those responsible to account." Certain commanders and units in the field were anyway particularly viciously disposed. Among the worst offenders were the higher quality formations the Germans employed from 1943 in a series of bigger, more powerful operations launched by the Wehrmacht against the partisans during the first half of that year, in the hope of annihilating them once and for all. The 7th Waffen-SS Division, Prinz Eugen, was a particularly well-equipped unit composed almost entirely of ethnic Germans from the Yugoslav regions. So grievously did its barbaric conduct alienate the civilian population that it cancelled out much of the division's military contribution. And in May 1943, the Army's own 1st Mountain Division displayed a ruthlessness that would increasingly characterize elite Army formations participating in anti-partisan operations in Yugoslavia by shooting around 80% of the prisoners taken during Operation Black. Frank Deakin, a British SOE operative in Yugoslavia, conveys in miniature both the Germans' callousness during these operations and the human cost they exacted in his description of an incident during an anti-partisan operation in Bosnia. "In one cave, where 90 men, women and children huddled together, a German patrol approached within 10 yards without perceiving the entrance. At that moment, a newborn baby began crying, and the mother sought to calm the child. The wailing continued, and panic seized hold of the people. A voice whispered to kill the baby, and the mother held out the infant in silent resignation. Even in terror, no one had the will to commit the act. The mother strangled the infant. The Germans appeared at the mouth of the cave, shot down some of the aged occupants, and moved on their way. A child's cradle has remained in the cave since that day." By the spring of 1943, the more powerful units the Germans were at last committing were no longer able to defeat the partisans decisively. In April, 2nd Lieutenant Peter G. testified to the partisans' growing fighting power. "The partisans have made a sudden and unexpected strike against us, which regrettably cost us a lot of blood. By day they threatened a neighboring town. The imperative was to counterattack as quickly as possible to exterminate them. I was part of the assembled Jagdkommando. We only got back this morning. It was a hunt in the truest sense of the word. Unbelievably hard and bitter, and the partisans were hiding in unknown strength. We lost 27 dead and 44 wounded. Around the same time, the partisans thrashed their Chetnik rivals in open combat at the Battle of the Neretva. By now, over 150,000 partisans were operating in the NDH. Since early 1942, their various strengths and the weaknesses and mistakes of their opponents had enabled the partisans to survive, endure, and expand. By the spring of 1943, they had reached a critical mass that enabled them to withstand the stronger blows the Germans were now finally able to land on them. This, in turn, set the stage for a still more dramatic increase in partisan strength during the final months of 1943. During 1942 and the first half of 1943, the German army's occupation of Western Europe and the Balkans took a turn even harsher than that of late 1941. The turn took different forms, and the non-Jewish populations of the army's occupied Western European territories were terrorized to nothing like the same extent as the peoples of Yugoslavia and, increasingly, of Greece. Nevertheless, the army's behavior showed ruthless resolve in both regions. In the West, the occupation hardened in large part because the Reich sought increasingly to exploit the region's economic resources, particularly its labor, as the demands of the German war economy grew more severe. Yet the military government in Brussels was more proactive in dragooning its territory's workforce than the military government in Paris was. Indeed, the main push to this end in France came from negotiations between the Vichy regime and the Office of the Four-Year Plan, negotiations to which the military government itself was not especially party. It was a similar story when it came to the military government's involvement in the extermination of the Jews. Neither military government considered this a top priority, but the military government in Brussels, in large part for its own power political reasons, now gave the task more attention and energy than it had done before, or that the military government in Paris continued to give. In Salonika, the army's eventual involvement in the extermination of the Jews in 1943 was prefaced by the degrading treatment to which it subjected them in 1942. This was not only the work of higher-level commands, but also of units on the spot taking gratuitous advantage. It was yet another sign of how far anti-Semitism had permeated the army's various levels. In the Balkans, the effects of economic plunder were only one reason why resistance was on the rise. Resistance movements in both Greece and Yugoslavia were also engaged in a civil war fueled by internecine hatred. The Reich leadership could be blamed for the rise in resistance, however, not only because it plundered its Balkan territories, but also because it had sought to occupy Greece and Yugoslavia on the cheap, relying heavily upon allied, satellite, and indigenous forces of dubious worth to help keep order. In Yugoslavia, as in the Soviet Union, some of the army's anti-partisan units were sensible enough to appreciate the value of cultivating hearts and minds. But the German response overall showed much more ruthlessness than restraint. This was partly for the same reasons as in the Soviet Union. The response was carried out by overburdened security forces subject to an anti-partisan doctrine colored by ideology and guerrilla phobia. They faced an elusive, dangerous, and sometimes barbaric partisan opponent in terrain that was a gift to guerrilla warfare and succumbed to profoundly brutalizing frustration in the process. The anti-partisan campaign also became more vicious because of the succession of radical directives issued by the High Command during the second half of 1942. Some of the worst offenders of all were the better-equipped units that the army committed to anti-partisan operations. This was an early example of a pattern that would appear repeatedly during the anti-partisan warfare the army would wage into 1944. In turn, it would reveal ever darker truths about its soldiery. Chapter 16. The Initiative Lost, 1943. The German army could still throw the Allies off balance during the first half of 1943, but no more than that. Through the spring and early summer, it suffered further disastrous defeats in the Mediterranean and Eastern theatres. These did not turn the tide against Germany, that had turned already. But together with the tilting balance against the U-boat in the Battle of the Atlantic, they hastened Germany's overall defeat. Among other things, it was during this period that the German army clashed for the first time with the U.S. Army in North Africa. The U.S. Army of early 1943 fell far short of being a fully effective fighting force, but the battles between the two would show that ultimately the Germans' operational skill and high-quality hardware were not enough to overcome an opponent possessing superior firepower and resources. And all this at a time when events reaffirmed Hitler's determination to take Germany to final victory or to ultimate destruction. For in January 1943, the Western Allied leaders agreed to fight alongside the Soviet Union until they had secured the Axis powers' unconditional surrender, and, in President Roosevelt's words, imposed punishment and retribution in full upon their guilty, barbaric leaders. In the wake of this announcement and of the Stalingrad calamity, Goebbels sought to persuade the Germans to accept that national defeat and national destruction were now a real possibility, and that they must adopt a true total war mentality in order to drive up armaments production and save Germany from catastrophe. As the Battle of Stalingrad drew to a close, German troops along the entire Eastern Front were already increasingly fatalistic about the course the war was taking. From 1942 onwards, Major Freiherr von Lersner of the OKH paid a succession of visits to the troops on various fronts, and his reports provide numerous insights into how junior officers and their men regarded National Socialism and the war. Visiting the 16th Army in northwest Russia in late January 1943, Lersner noted one discussion with an officer who simply declared, "I understand nothing anymore. Stalingrad is madness. I had to get that off my chest. I need to go back to work now."